Every country on earth is in debt. The United States owes $38 trillion. Japan owes $9 trillion. The entire planet owes $315 trillion, three times the size of the global economy. But here's the paradox that should terrify you. If everyone owes money, who exactly is owed? The answer isn't what you think. Because when you follow the chain of creditors, when you track who actually holds the debt, you discover something disturbing. The world doesn't owe money to anyone in particular. It owes money to itself. But four men, four bankers across three centuries, designed it that way, deliberately. They built a system where debt can never be repaid, where governments borrow forever, where interest flows eternally upward, and where the people who designed the trap profit from every payment, every crisis, every bailout. This isn't conspiracy. This is documented history. The meetings happened. The contracts exist. The mechanisms are public record. And once you see how they built it, you'll understand why $38 trillion isn't a problem to be solved. It's the system working exactly as designed. Let me show you the four architects, the four moments when the debt trap was engineered, and why every government on earth is now caught inside it with no way out. Before 1694, kings borrowed money the old way. They'd go to merchants or nobles, promise repayment with interest, and if they couldn't pay, they'd default. Creditors lost money. Kings borrowed from someone else. It was risky for lenders and embarrassing for kings, but it was contained. Debt was temporary, either repaid or defaulted. The system cleared. William Paterson changed everything. He was a Scottish merchant and financial schemer who tried and failed multiple times to get rich. In 1691, he had an idea that would reshape civilization. England was at war with France. King William III needed money desperately. The treasury was empty. Tax revenue couldn't cover war costs. And traditional lenders were refusing new loans because England had defaulted before. Paterson approached the king with a proposal. He would organize a group of wealthy merchants to lend the government £1.2 million. That's about $300 million in today's money. A massive sum. But here's the innovation. The loan would never be repaid. Instead, the government would pay interest forever, 8% annually. And to manage this arrangement, Paterson proposed creating a new institution, the Bank of England. The mechanics were revolutionary. The merchant lenders would give their gold to the Bank of England. The bank would lend it to the government. The government would pay interest annually from tax revenue. And the bank would pay that interest to the merchant lenders. But here's the critical detail. The government wouldn't repay the principal, ever. The loan was permanent. Why would merchants accept this? Because the interest payment was guaranteed by Parliament. It was backed by the government's taxing power. As long as England could tax its citizens, the interest would flow. And the banknotes the lenders received in exchange for their gold could be traded. They were as good as money, better than money, because they paid interest. Parliament approved Paterson's scheme in 1694. The Bank of England was chartered. The merchants provided their gold. The government got its war funding. And for the first time in history, national debt became permanent. Not a problem to solve, a feature of the system. And here's what nobody explains about why this was brilliant for the bankers. The government paid 8% interest annually on £1.2 million. That's £96,000 per year, forever. The merchants had essentially bought an annuity from the government. As long as England existed, as long as it could tax, the money flowed. And if they wanted their gold back, they could sell the banknotes to someone else. The debt was transferable but never repayable. But Paterson's real genius was what came next. The Bank of England was given the right to issue banknotes backed by the government's debt. They could print paper money up to the value of the loan. This created money out of debt. The government's IOU became currency. And the more the government borrowed, the more money could be created. This is the template. Government borrows. Never repays principal. Pays interest forever. And the debt itself becomes money. It's brilliant if you're a banker. Catastrophic if you're a taxpayer. Because you're paying interest on debt that will never disappear. Within 50 years, every major European power copied the model. France created the Banque Générale. The Netherlands already had sophisticated banking, but formalized government debt issuance. And by 1790, the newly independent United States adopted the same system. Alexander Hamilton, who we talked about before, explicitly modeled America's financial system on the Bank of England, permanent debt, interest paid from taxes, bonds traded as currency. Paterson died in 1719, not particularly wealthy, despite creating the Bank of England. But the system he built persists 331 years later. The Bank of England still exists. British government debt has never been paid off. It's been refinanced, rolled over, and expanded, but never eliminated. The debt trap was set in 1694, and every government since has walked into it willingly. By the early 1800s, European governments had embraced debt. They borrowed for wars, for infrastructure, for operating expenses. But there was no organized market. Each loan was negotiated individually. Interest rates varied wildly, and only the wealthiest merchants could participate. Nathan Rothschild changed that. He industrialized sovereign debt. The Rothschild family started as money changers and traders in Frankfurt. By 1800, the five Rothschild brothers had established banking houses in five major European cities: London, Paris, Frankfurt, Vienna, Naples. This network was unprecedented. They could move money across borders faster than anyone else, and they used this to dominate sovereign debt issuance. Nathan Rothschild in London was the strategic genius. During the Napoleonic Wars, Nathan arranged loans for Britain, but his innovation was how he structured them. Instead of lending directly to the government, he bought government bonds at a discount and resold them to investors at a markup. He created a secondary market. Government needed money. Rothschild provided it immediately. Then he sold the bonds to pension funds, insurance companies, and wealthy individuals. The government got its money fast. Rothschild collected the spread. And investors got a tradable asset. But here's where it gets darker. Rothschild didn't just finance governments. He positioned himself so governments had no choice but to use him. In 1815, at the Battle of Waterloo, Nathan Rothschild famously learned of Napoleon's defeat before anyone else in London. His courier network was faster than official channels. He used this information to manipulate the bond market. First, he sold British bonds, signaling that Britain was losing. Prices collapsed. Other investors panicked and sold. Then, after prices crashed, Rothschild bought massive quantities at rock-bottom prices. When news of British victory arrived the next day, bond prices surged. Rothschild made millions, not from insider trading as we'd call it today, but from controlling information and market timing. This established the Rothschild model. Control the information, control the issuance, control the market. By 1820, the Rothschilds dominated European sovereign debt. If a government needed to borrow, they went through the Rothschilds, because the Rothschilds controlled the investor network. They had the distribution, and they set the terms. Here's why this matters for the debt trap. Before Rothschild, governments could theoretically refuse to pay. If a king defaulted, his creditors lost money and the system reset. But Rothschild made sovereign debt tradable across borders. A British bond might be owned by a French investor who sold it to a German bank who used it as collateral for a loan to an Austrian aristocrat. The web of ownership became so complex that defaulting wasn't just refusing one creditor. It was collapsing an entire international financial network. This is the Rothschild innovation. Make debt so interconnected that default becomes impossible. Not because governments are responsible, because default would trigger systemic collapse. Governments became trapped. They had to keep paying. And they had to keep borrowing to pay the interest on old debts. The debt trap was no longer just permanent. It was inescapable. The Rothschild family wealth peaked in the mid-1800s. They were the richest family in the world, richer than any king. And that wealth came from one source, interest on sovereign debt. They didn't produce anything, didn't build anything. They lent money to governments and collected interest forever. The system Patterson created in 1694, Rothschild industrialized by 1815, and every government in Europe was caught. By 1900, America was becoming an economic powerhouse, but it still had a primitive financial system. Banks operated independently. Money supply was tied to gold, and there was no central mechanism to manage debt. J.P. Morgan fixed that. Not for the public good, to protect his banking empire. In 1907, there was a financial panic. Stock prices crashed, banks failed, and the economy seized up. J.P. Morgan personally organized a bailout. He gathered the major New York bankers in his library, locked the doors, and forced them to pledge their own money to stabilize failing banks. It worked. The panic ended, and Morgan became the de facto central banker of America. But he was 70 years old. He knew he couldn't do it again. So Morgan and his associates, the most powerful bankers in America, designed a permanent solution. They needed a central bank. But Americans hated central banks. The first and second banks of the United States had been shut down by populist opposition. So Morgan's group disguised it. In 1910, Morgan's associates, including Senator Nelson Aldrich and representatives from the largest banks, held a secret meeting on Jekyll Island, Georgia. For 9 days, they designed the structure of what would become the Federal Reserve System. The meetings were secret because they knew if the public found out that bankers were designing the nation as a monetary system, there would be riots. The plan was brilliant political manipulation. The Federal Reserve wouldn't be called a central bank. It would be called a Federal Reserve System. It wouldn't be one institution. It would be 12 regional banks. It wouldn't be controlled by Wall Street. It would be overseen by a board of governors appointed by the president. It looked decentralized, democratic, public. But the structure ensured banker control. The regional Federal Reserve banks were privately owned by member banks. Those banks elected the boards of the regional feds, and the regional feds elected the Federal Reserve Board. The government appointed some members, but the bankers controlled the system. And the most important power, the power to create money and buy government bonds, was given to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which was controlled by the largest Wall Street banks, Morgan's banks. The Federal Reserve Act passed Congress in December 1913, largely because most representatives didn't understand what they were voting for. And immediately, the debt trap expanded. Now, the government didn't just borrow from banks. It borrowed from the Federal Reserve, which could create money to buy bonds. Unlimited demand for government debt. Here's why this matters. Before the Federal Reserve, there was a limit to how much the government could borrow. Banks only had so much money to lend, but the Federal Reserve could create money by purchasing government bonds. The government issues a bond. The Fed buys it with newly created money. The government spends the money. And the debt goes on the Fed's balance sheet, backed by nothing but the promise that taxpayers will service it forever. This is the mechanism that enables infinite debt. The Federal Reserve ensures there's always a buyer for government bonds, always demand, so the government never has to stop borrowing. It can roll over debt forever because the Fed will always buy it. And the interest payments flow from taxpayers to the banks that own the Federal Reserve System. Morgan died in 1913, the same year the Federal Reserve was created, but his legacy is the structure that makes the current $38 trillion in U.S. debt possible. Without the Federal Reserve, the government couldn't borrow at this scale. The market wouldn't support it. But with the Fed as a guaranteed buyer, there's no limit. The debt trap became infinite. By the 1970s, the debt trap Patterson, Rothschild, and Morgan built was functioning globally. Every developed nation borrowed, rolled over debt, paid interest. But developing nations were different. They borrowed for infrastructure, and many couldn't keep up payments. The debt trap was reaching its limits, until Paul Volcker made it permanent. Volcker was Federal Reserve Chairman from 1979 to 1987, and he faced a problem. Inflation was over 10%, U.S. credibility was eroding, foreign governments were losing faith in the dollar. He needed to stop inflation, even if it meant causing a recession. So in 1979, Volcker raised interest rates dramatically. The federal funds rate went from 11% to 20%, the highest in American history. This crushed inflation. But it had another effect. Developing nations had borrowed billions of dollars during the 1970s when rates were low. Now those loans were due, and the interest rates had tripled. Mexico owed $80 billion, Brazil $60 billion, Argentina $40 billion, and they couldn't pay. The interest alone exceeded their export revenues. In August 1982, Mexico announced it couldn't make payments. Default. This should have triggered global financial collapse. American banks had lent most of that money. If Mexico defaulted, Citibank, Bank of America, Chase Manhattan, all would take massive losses. Some might fail. The entire banking system was at risk. Volcker could have let it happen. Let the banks take losses. Let the market clear. But he didn't. Instead, he orchestrated a bailout through the International Monetary Fund. The IMF would lend Mexico, Brazil, Argentina, and others enough money to keep making interest payments to American banks. The loans were called structural adjustment loans, and they came with conditions. The conditions were brutal. Governments had to cut spending, privatize state assets, open markets to foreign investment, devalue currencies, basically dismantle their economic sovereignty in exchange for the money to keep paying interest. And here's the key. The IMF loans didn't reduce debt. They just rolled it over, made it manageable, but permanent. This is the Volcker innovation. When debt becomes unpayable, don't forgive it, restructure it, lend enough to keep interest payments flowing, and extract political and economic concessions in exchange. The debt trap became a tool of control. Countries that couldn't pay were forced to open their economies, sell their assets, and submit to foreign economic policy in exchange for the privilege of staying in debt. This pattern has repeated for 40 years. Greece in 2010, Argentina in 2001, Sri Lanka in 2022, every time the same structure. IMF loans to keep paying interest, austerity imposed, sovereignty surrendered. And the debt never eliminated, just restructured, made perpetual. Volcker died in 2019. But his legacy is the mechanism that ensures the debt trap is global and inescapable. Even when countries can't pay, they're not allowed to default. They're refinanced into permanent indebtedness. And the interest keeps flowing to the creditors. The same banks, the same institutions, the same system Patterson created in 1694. Now let me show you how these four architects built a system where debt is infinite and escape is impossible. Start with Patterson's model. Government borrows, pays interest forever, never repays principal. Add Rothschild's innovation, make the debt tradable globally. So it's not one creditor, it's a web. Default collapses the system. Add Morgan's mechanism. Central banks create money to buy government bonds. Unlimited demand. Government can always borrow more. Add Volcker's trap. When countries can't pay, restructure, don't forgive, keep the interest flowing. The result is what we have today. $315 trillion in global debt. Government debt, corporate debt, household debt. None of it will ever be repaid. All of it pays interest. And all of it is connected through the financial system. So default anywhere threatens collapse everywhere. Here's the specific mechanism. The U.S. government issues $38 trillion in debt. Who owns it? About $20 trillion is owned by the American public. Pension funds, mutual funds, insurance companies, banks, and the Federal Reserve. These institutions buy treasury bonds because they're considered safe assets. But those bonds pay interest, about $1 trillion per year now. That interest comes from taxes, so taxpayers send money to the government. The government sends it to bondholders. The bondholders are mostly institutions owned by the wealthy. It's a transfer from workers to capital, every year, forever. The other $18 trillion is owed to the government itself, Social Security Trust Fund, Medicare Trust Fund. The government borrowed from these programs and spent the money. Now it owes itself, but ultimately, taxpayers owe. Because when Social Security needs to redeem those bonds, the government has to raise taxes or borrow more to pay. It's a shell game, but the interest flows regardless. Now scale it globally. Japan owes $9 trillion, mostly to Japanese institutions and the Bank of Japan. Europe owes $14 trillion, mostly to European banks and the ECB. China owes significant domestic debt held by state banks. Every country is running the same system, and they're all interconnected. Japan holds U.S. treasuries. The U.S. holds European bonds through the IMF. Europe holds developing nation debt through the World Bank. It's circular. Everyone owes everyone. And the interest flows upward to the institutions that manage the debt. Here's why this can never end. If the U.S. paid off its $38 trillion, the money supply would collapse. Because dollars are created when the government borrows, if it paid off the debt, those dollars would disappear. Deflation, depression, economic collapse. So the government can never pay it off. It has to keep borrowing, keep rolling it over, and keep paying interest. The same is true globally. If every government paid off its debt, the global money supply would shrink by two-thirds. There wouldn't be enough money to conduct trade. The system would seize. So debt can't be eliminated. It's structural. Necessary. By design. And here's who profits. The institutions that hold the debt. BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Fidelity. These asset managers control tens of trillions. They buy government bonds with other people's money. Pension funds, retirement accounts, insurance premiums. And they collect the interest. About $1 trillion per year from U.S. debt alone. Plus, interest from Japan, Europe, everywhere. That trillion per year in interest payments flows from taxpayers to bondholders. It's the largest wealth transfer in history, continuous, structural, and invisible to most people. Because it's not called a tax, it's called debt service. But it's the same mechanism. Workers pay, institutions collect, and the debt never decreases. Now, here's the final piece. The four architects didn't conspire together. They lived in different centuries. But they each solved a problem in a way that benefited bankers. And each solution built on the previous one. Patterson made debt permanent in 1694. Rothschild made it global in 1815. Morgan made it infinite in 1913. Volcker made it inescapable in 1982. Together, they built a system where governments borrow forever and pay interest eternally. And the people who control the bonds, who manage the debt, who collect the interest, they're the ultimate beneficiaries. Not governments, not taxpayers. The financial institutions. And here's the final truth. $38 trillion isn't a crisis for them. It's a business model. Every dollar of debt is an asset on someone's balance sheet. It pays interest. It provides collateral for more borrowing. And as long as confidence holds, as long as people believe the government will pay interest even if it never repays principal, the system functions. The debt trap is complete. An escape isn't possible, not without collapsing the entire financial system. Four architects, three centuries, one system. And everyone on Earth is now caught inside it. If this changed how you see government debt, if you finally understand that $38 trillion is not an accident or a mistake, but a system working exactly as designed, then you're starting to see how power actually works. Subscribe if you want to understand how the machine was built and who's operating it, because they're not going to teach you this in school. They're going to teach you that debt is a problem to solve. But the architects knew better. Debt isn't a problem, it's the foundation. And interest is the rent we pay to live in their system.